So tell me about this bet that you put on for your dad, which I seems to be maybe the first.
The very first one.
The very first one. How did that come about?
There used to be racing on the telly on Saturday afternoons, and he'd often be at home on a Saturday because he wouldn't work, and he was always a man for going for a pint on a Friday night after work. So he'd probably be hungover, and you'd rarely see him going out on a Saturday. So he used to send me down to the bookies to do a little bet for him, down to Banbury's and Thomangate, it was called. And back then, in a bookies, you had a note. It was like a notepad, and there was a carbon blotting sheet underneath it. So you wrote your bet, you brought it up to the girl, she'd stamp it, give you back the carbon copy, keep the original. He gave me the names of the three horses or whatever it was. I wrote them out, and next thing, I'm here, I've got 30 pence in my hand, three 10 pences. And he wanted to do 30 pence to win on three horses. I was thinking, sure, he's not going to know the difference, is he? Because the first thing I could think of was the carbon paper. It's not going to add up if I change it. And then I was thinking, how can I change it? So I took the carbon paper, lifted up the first sheet, and wrote the bet for 10 pence. She stamped it. I gave her the 10 pence. When she gave me the foil, I went back to it, and I doctored the one into a three. So when I went home, I handed him the slip. He looked at it, 30 pence, happy days. His bet's on, he didn't care. And I'm just thinking to myself, sure, he never wins anyway. I'll win. And this day, the three of them won. So he was all happy with that. And he said, oh, that's great, great, great. So I remember he got up, he got dressed, and he was going to walk down and collect his winnings. And I knew when he came back, because I could hear the roar, where is he? Where is he when he opened the door? So he only literally got the equivalent of having 10 pence on the three rather than the 30 pence on the three, which he did. So he only got a third of his winnings. So he wasn't happy about that. So I got a slap. I got roared at. My mother got roared at. Everyone got roared at. That would have been the first conceivable little scam or stroke that I can remember ever pulling. You know, I don't even know if you'd find this hard to believe or not. I used to be extremely, I wouldn't say religious, but I used to go to Mass regularly. I went to Christian Brothers schools. I was God-fearing, really was God-fearing. And I used to do things like that. I'd go up and I'd lock myself in my room, and I'd get down on my knees at the side of the bed, and I would pray to Jesus. I would pray to God, all apologetic, looking for forgiveness. I'd go to confession and I would tell a priest what I'd done in confession and get my three Hail Marys and two Our Fathers or whatever the case may be. I'm not one of these fellas that ever did anything without a conscience. Everything I did brought huge guilt around it. But I always suppressed the guilt. I always kind of kept it to myself. Like, if I did wrong to you, I'd pay you back, but I'd find it very hard to sit down and look you in the eye and talk to you about it and tell you why I did it. I couldn't do that. I had a kind of a secret existence going on in here with all of that. I internalized everything, really. For years and years and years and years, I used to think that I was just genuinely a really, really, really bad person. I used to think I was just one of these people that's just rotten to the core, because I could think back for over 40 years I'm doing this shit. Nobody's that stupid. And I'm not stupid, and I know I'm not stupid. And then I'm doing these things without fear of consequence.
From Wine Tavern Productions, in association with Go Loud, this is The Gambler. Episode 2, The Ginger Kid.
Now, I left here at these lights. You're now entering Beirut, as it's known as. This is my Ross. You know, you mention it to somebody from Dublin or somebody from outside, I'm driving through my Ross, they literally shit themselves. I'm not going through my Ross. Nothing happens here, really, to be honest with you. They go elsewhere to do their... to do whatever it is they need to do. When my Ross was built first, there was just that estate, the brown houses there called Cosgrove Park. The red ones there on the hill, we'll get them on the way back, it's called Dalgish Park. And the one I live in is just past that, it's called Cliona Park. So we went into Cliona Park. We were one of the first people to move in there.
What was Limerick like then, before, I suppose, the gangs?
Limerick was fantastic. It was probably the best city you could grow up in if you were a young fella.
because it was sports mad. And if you were into sport, it had everything.
We all hung out together every day. We played football, we played rugby, we played everything every day after school. We went to school together. We played GAA with the same teams, we played rugby with the same teams growing up. There was no real drug problems. There was no violence. There was no feuds. There was nothing. Like, it was, Marass was a great place to grow up back then. Absolutely fantastic.
Do you remember it changing?
Oh, yeah, big time. I went to live in Dublin in 1991, and I used to come home every second weekend or whatever the case may be, and then towards the mid to late 90s, the whole vibe of the place just started to change. There started to be a lot more Garda presence. But the minute the drugs came in, that was it. It totally took over, and it took the place over in no time. In hindsight, I wouldn't have changed it for anything, to be honest with you. It was a great place to grow up. We're just happy times, you know. We were happy children.
My mother and father were growing up for like every normal couple you could meet. My father worked. My father was always a worker. There's one thing I always admired about him was that he never missed a day's work, as long as I can remember him. He worked in a factory. He was a supervisor in a textiles factory initially, and then he went to work in a big computer factory. Same job, he was management. Never, ever, ever missed a day's work. Loved his pint, loved his sport, loved his Ireland, and loved his rugby. Dad would have taken me to rugby matches. He would have taken me to hurling matches, Munster Championship hurling matches every summer. We'd go to them. Mam was never into travelling or sport or anything like that, you know. My mother was your typical overprotective housewife. She fought with him like cat and dog. But at the end of the day, they were married since 1966, you know. Chalk and cheese, the two of them, in many, many, many ways. And I suppose that's what kept them together. That's what made them work. Like, when it came to decisions in the house, she would have been the boss, really, you know. He would have went along with things. If he disagreed with it, they'd have an argument. She'd still get her way, you know.
Now, this in here on the left-hand side is the first school I ever went to. It's called St. Munchan's. And that was where the first shots were fired in the famous Keane-Ryan feud. Right here, Eddie Ryan tried to kill Christy Keane. Right there.
I had good memories of primary school. I had bad memories of primary school. The good ones being making friends, playing sports, those kind of things. The bad ones being getting slagged all the time because I had red hair and glasses. And I know that sounds kind of funny, but when you're a kid, when you're a small child, you know, if you're anyway sensitive, it can affect you, you know. It can, if you develop insecurities and all that kind of stuff. And I started to develop them at a very early age.
This is the Shelburne Road. You'd be coming into a more affluent part of Limerick up here now. That's my secondary school, Art School Rish. That would be one of the better, if not the best, secondary school in Limerick. This is where I used to hang out after school down around here. I used to go to guys' houses. I ended up going out with a girl down here when I was 16 or whatever. And this is all I wanted to be part of. This was, you know, this was what I wanted to be. You know, like, houses like those, you know, they're probably million-pound houses if they're in Dublin. Like, I don't know. And that was where I first started to develop all the insecurities about myself, because I felt I wasn't worthy, I suppose, for want of a better word, of going to a well-to-do school with all these well-to-do lads. And I felt they looked down their noses at me because I came from Wairos.
I remember one day we played a rugby match. We went to play a school's rugby match against a team called Crescent Comprehensive, a school at the other side of town. And parents would have come to give us lifts. So my dad came along, and I'm totally ashamed of this today, but I was fucking mortified. Drove up in a 10-year-old Ford Escort, big red Ford Escort, spluttering out exhaust fumes. And the other three cars that brought fellas up were a Range Rover, a Merc, and something else. And I was kind of going, Jesus. And I could hear a couple of lads kind of sneering about it. And that got me, you know. And that only just fueled the insecurities that I had.
And it was very shortly after that, after I started in this school, that I actually placed my first bet and won a few quid and had money and was able to come into school wearing fancy new jacket or take the lads into town after school for burgers and milkshakes or just do stuff like that that made me popular. That made me feel good about myself then. And all I was doing in hindsight was literally buying affection. I couldn't see that at the time. And I developed a huge stigma, I suppose, about being from Moyross because of going to school here and mixing with all these kind of people. I believe that that was the beginning of me ending up going down the road I went down.
The gambling came into it when I was about 15. I had a few bob in my pocket one day, I remember, and I walked to town. I'm not quite sure what drew me in there. I'd been thinking about it, I suppose, subconsciously for a while or whatever. There was something about the betting office when I went in there that I liked because no one judged me straight away. And I remember going in there and I felt safe in there, I suppose. I kind of felt, this isn't too bad. And then the worst thing that ever happened to me in my life happened to me. I did a bet and the bet won.
I went into a really small betting shop. It wouldn't have been like a betting shop today full of couches and coffee machines and 50-inch plasma TVs. It was a small, pokey room with a tannoy speaker and a radio in it, and it was just full of what I considered at the time to be awful as smoking cigarettes. The first bet I did would have been the highest risk type of bet that would have had the biggest reward. It wasn't just a smaller, more conservative bet which you could have done, but I went for a thing called an accumulator, which was an all or nothing. And I knew nothing about horses, but I picked out four of them, put 50 pence on the four of them, and then over the course of the next 2 hours, they all started winning one by one. And I remember the fourth guy won. Next thing I knew, they were lifting me up and I was on their shoulders and there was cheers and roars and shouts. And I didn't realise the full extent of it till about 20 minutes later when I went up to collect the money and the woman behind the counter told me I had to wait because she had to open up the safe. And now you have to bear in mind, this was in 1983, like, and she gave me back £51. Now, for a 50 pence bet, that's the equivalent of a 100-to-1 winner. And back then, I think the average weekly wage was about 100 quid a week. You could buy a pint for 40 pence, that kind of thing. So it was a serious, serious amount of money, like, for a 14, 15-year-old young fella to have. And I literally didn't know what to do with it when I was walking home. I didn't know whether to give it to my parents. If I gave it to my parents, I'd have to explain to them where I came from, and I got a slap for that. I, being honest, don't really remember what I did with it. I know that I did start gambling again fairly quickly afterwards, maybe within a few weeks of that. And after that, it just became a very, very, very quick thing. It was very, very regular after that.
Did you tell them in school?
God, no. No, no, no.
Tell anyone?
No. Nobody. Nobody.
It sounds kind of harmless now, but this bet was really the start of Pat's journey to prison. 40 years have passed since that day, but it's still the moment that he looks back on and says, that's where things changed. That's where things started to go wrong. And all the scams, all the fraud, all the gambling, all of that really began with winning that one bet back in 1983. It really changed his life forever. Pat's gambling only got worse in the years after that. He managed to finish school, but he wasn't all that interested in college. So he stayed in Limerick, working first for a local newspaper and then in a factory, like his dad.
It was the tail end of the 1980s, a decade that had been hard on the country in a lot of ways. And Limerick was still quite a small, quite a poor city back then. And it didn't take long for a smart, ambitious young lad like Pat to make an impression.
I would have developed a reputation of being the kind of go-to guy, you know, insofar as if people were looking for stuff. Like, I'd have people ringing me up, oh, somebody give me your number, can you get me a ticket for this? Or somebody give me your number, can you recommend this place for me? Or blah, 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 that kind of stuff. So really, I had this kind of man around town persona that knew everybody who knew everything. And I would have always made sure the people either knew who I was or knew what I could do. Like, I would do stupid shit for people for popularity, purely for popularity. I would get myself into trouble, like by pulling strokes, getting to get people things. And they wouldn't, you know, in hindsight, they didn't really care. They were delighted. Oh, Pat's great. Pat got me this. They don't really care. They didn't care when Pat was in court getting 6 months off a judge or getting fined or, you know. But I couldn't see any of that. I was just so caught up in everything that was going on. There was times where I would go out of my way to help people who didn't even look for it. I mean, I could overhear a conversation with you, say if you were talking to Nicola or something and you were saying, Jesus, I'd love to go and see whatever. I'd sit there and I'd go, right, okay. And I'd be gone trying to get you something that you didn't even ask me for. And sometimes not even for financial gain, I mightn't even look for money off you offered, but I'd be giving it to you because that's you looking at me like I'm something fantastic. Do you understand? It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
Were you good in school, like academically?
Yeah, I was okay. I wasn't the best at applying myself. You know, I suppose I'd be your typical could try harder guy on this, but like I got a very good junior cert, I got a very good leaving cert. You know, I have no problems academically at all. But my problem from an academic point of view, or from pushing myself from an academic point of view, I'd say stemmed from, I saw how easy it was to make money. So easy was to make money from advertising, that kind of thing. And then when I was gambling, you know, and that consumed me. So I was thinking, why would I bother, you know, going down the academic route when I can make my money this way? Make it quick, make it fast. That was the thing. It's all about instant gratification with it. Like, I was very impatient and very, not needy, but I wanted, I became very ambitious. I would have been in my early 20s. I was drinking in a pub called the Brazen Head, which would have been not far from here. It was kind of a hip, trendy place. Basically everything that I wanted, all the kind of people that I wanted to be seen with, drank in this place. I befriended a guy. He used to play a bit of rugby and we'd go in there fairly regularly. And Colin was barman there and he loved his bets. And I went in, I used to go in on Saturdays when I was in town. And I'd go in there for a bowl of soup or something around lunchtime, watch a race or two. And he came up to me one day, there was nobody in the pub, and we just discussed. He said, well, we do a Yankee together. I said, yeah, sure, why not? So you pick two and I'll pick two. So we picked two each and we did a Yankee. It's a bet where there's permutations, like you can have four horses. If any two of them win, you'll get what's called a double, where one price goes on to another, which more or less covers your stake. If three of them win, they go to doubles and trebles and things like that, and you make a nice few quid. If the four of them win, you're in clover. I mean, because there's so many different permutations, they all keep adding up and adding up and adding up. I remember I picked two horses and he picked two. It kind of stretched out over the course of the afternoon. First horse won and it was one of mine. It was 5-1, which is kind of a good price. So that was a great start. And then after that, one of his won. And then we had to wait about an hour for the third one. And to be honest, when I did that bet with him, I was more excited about having done the bet with him and being part of the whole wanted kind of thing in there. And I felt part of the furniture. Actually, we did an old bet with this. You know, it was a big thing for me. I didn't give a shit whether it won or not. So then the third one came on and it was the second one of the ones I picked and it won. So at this stage, we were up, I suppose, the bones of, I think we made it up. We won the bones of about 200 quid, which was great. Happy days, that's your weekend's drinking cover, whatever, the crack, more even. The very last one, then we had to wait an hour and a half or something like that for it. And at that stage, you were beginning to think, fuck, if that one wins, you know, it's going your holidays time. The whole pub, I remember the whole pub was busy and the whole pub just shut up. It was like being at a funeral to watch that race. It was Cullen's last one and it was a favourite that was supposed to win and it didn't look like it was going to win, and I remember it, and it got back up and it won, and couldn't believe it. There was hugs and claps and cheers and drink bought for everyone and the whole lot. And I remember he went to collect it, and at that time we were kind of doing the sums up in our head and we reckoned we probably won about 800 quid, which was, you know, serious money. Like, I was working at the time in a factory and I think I was walking home with 200 a week, like, so I mean, you know, 800 quid each, serious bet. He came back and next thing he threw me 500 quid and I'm going, geez, that's great, 500 quid, happy days. Thought it might have been a bit more, but I'm not complaining, it's 500 quid. That'll have to do till Monday, he said, they don't have enough to pay us. So we added it up and the bet was worth 2.5 grand each or something. And like, Jesus Christ, unbelievable. Unbelievable. I remember I was going to go back out home and get changed because I was going to go out that night, obviously, and celebrate. And there was a man's shop just down the road there called Tony Connolly, and he had a lovely leather jacket in the window. And I'd always wanted that jacket, and I went in and got it for myself. That's one little things you remember, you know. But like I said, with that bet, the mentality of it was being part of something. It meant as much, if not more, to me than the actual money did. Yeah.
This is another one of Pat's stories that I've often wondered, is it too good to be true? Because, you know, it happened 35 years ago, so we're not really able to fact check it. We haven't been able to track down the barman or anything like that. We haven't found anyone who was there on the day. So, as with lots of Pat's early life, we're kind of going on faith. We just have to trust that it probably happened, even if it wasn't exactly like he said it was. Whether it's true or not, it's a story that shows what the highs in gambling can be like. It must be an incredible feeling to have a win like that. But all gamblers know that you can't win every time. And from what Pat has told us, he was losing much more than he was winning.
But no matter how much he lost, he couldn't stop. As his gambling became more and more compulsive and desperate, other parts of Pat's life started to fall away. He was barely more than a kid, but things were already getting pretty bad.
I wasn't applying myself at work properly. I wasn't turning up for work because I was gambling. You know, things like that. I would have been preoccupied with gambling rather than working. And to be honest with you, it wasn't really a job that I wanted. It didn't fit in with my bigger picture or my big plan of being a fancy Dan with a fancy car and fancy suits, you know.
Pat wanted a life that was way beyond his means, and he saw gambling as the way to get it. But he needed money to bet, lots of money. Most people would just get a job, but Pat wasn't most people. He was too smart for that. He wanted more than a job could get him. So he did something most people would never do.
They'd moved in next door to us. They weren't there that long. I got quite friendly with John, the man that lived in the house. I was always in and out of the house. He was always in and out of my house. I'd been gambling a lot. I'd been gambling a good bit. I remember one day I went into the house and the checkbook was just up on the worktop, and it was just purely opportunistic. But at the same time, it wasn't opportunistic insofar as I went deliberately to the back of the checkbook and took the check at the back so I wouldn't be noticed for a while. I did that. I wrote it for £30. I brought it in. I cashed it. I can't even remember how long the £30 lasted, but it wouldn't have been long because it would have been gambled. You're only talking about £30, but that would have been one of the lower things I would have done, I think. You know, there were neighbours, there were good people. It was just a horrible thing to do.
Why do you think you did it?
Because I needed the money.
The Gambler is produced and presented by Nicola Tallant and me, Ian Molini. The executive producer for Go Loud is Owen Brennan, and Darren Cleary is the commissioning editor for Go Loud. Sound design is by Neil Kavanagh. The Go Loud promotion design and video team for The Gambler is Roisin Riley, Siobhan Walsh, Cameron Rooney, Andrew McConnell, and Dara Murphy. Legal support was from Mars Solicitors. If you have been affected by any of the issues raised in this series, you can contact Gambling Care on 1800 936 725 or visit gamblingcare.ie.